Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Live from the Green Space today, our ground floor theater here at 160 Varick Street. Right across the street, by the way, from a little winery called City Winery that's about to be torn down so a Disney headquarters skyscraper can go up in its place. But it is still charming down here, and City Winery gets to move and exist, I understand. But it is still charming down here in what is sometimes called West Soho. Give yourselves a round of applause for making the trek. Audience, if I say the word tabloid, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Shout it out.
Inquirer.
Oh, Inquirer. Yeah, I forgot about that. I wasn't even thinking about that. Okay, Inquirer. What else besides Inquirer?
New York Post.
New York Post.
Trashy News.
I thought you were all going to say iPad.
Rupert Murdoch.
I thought you were going to say iPad. How many of you grew up reading New York City tabloid newspapers? Jonathan, not that many.
Too many.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Which maybe shows the age of the crowd, or maybe a better question is, how many of you grew up reading the New York Times? Yeah. More, but how many of you grew up reading news online? How many of you were ever readers of Pete Hamill or Jimmy Breslin in the old tabloids? See, more people than grew up reading the tabloids know Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill.
They wrote for magazines and a lot of books, too. So
true. Yeah. Well, you weren't the only ones who were fans of Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin. They were also a big deal to Spike Lee.
Back in the day, I mean, you would buy the paper, see what Jimmy Breslin's saying, you know, Pete Hamill. I mean, these guys were like superstars. They were able to connect, and that's why people saw them as the voice of true New Yorkers.
That is Spike Lee, nominated for Best Director Oscar, by the way, for the first time, but appearing there near the beginning of an HBO documentary running now called Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists. We will hear more clips as we talk to the filmmaker, a top journalist and columnist in his own right, Jonathan Alter, Daily Beast columnist, NBC News and MSNBC contributor, author of books, including his two on the Obama presidency and The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. So we will get the pleasure of talking to Jonathan about today's headlines, maybe how the Green New Deal looks to someone who wrote a book about the original one, and about Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin and the journalism of yesterday and today. Please welcome Jonathan Alter back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. I love the green space. I love doing events here.
Have you done other stuff
yet?
Yes, I don't even
and
know.
It's always exciting. It takes it up a notch. So
that's great. We'll get to the film. Let me ask you the question I teased in the intro. Having written a book about FDR and the launch of the original New Deal, how do you see the New Deal framing? You don't have to critique everything about the Green New Deal, but the New Deal framing, as familiar as you are with that language, for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the others behind the Green New Deal?
I think it's terrific. And it actually fills a real gap in Democratic Party framing of issues, which has been a real problem. There's been improvement lately. Calling it Medicare for All is better than single payer. Like, I never understood, why do Democrats call it single? What the hell is that? You know, there was a problem with political language that Democrats had for a long time. And calling it the Green New Deal, it signals that it's about jobs, that it is about what FDR called bold, persistent experimentation to confront our problems. And it's all positive as long as they don't attach the S word, socialism. Now, there are a lot of younger people go, well, what the hell is wrong with socialism? For older people, I think they understand that it's politically potentially toxic to get tarred with that. And Franklin Roosevelt never wanted his program to be called socialism. He knew that that would be very damaging politically. So why lead with your chin by calling it socialism? Stick with the Green New Deal, which conveys a lot of great messaging.
And on the skepticism with which the Green New Deal is being met, in some quarters, even Nancy Pelosi seemed dismissive of it in a few comments. Ocasio-Cortez criticized ordinary party strategy last week for being too short-term oriented, right? Too focused on playing it safe to win a few elections in the next cycle, like with outdated Bill Clinton centrism, which is keeping the party from becoming the long-term big tent party that FDR made it back then with big ideas. That's kind of a Ocasio-Cortez and allies take. How much do you agree?
I think she's a great fresh voice in the Democratic Party and in our politics in general. And I think thinking big and thinking long-term and in a visionary way is very positive. Now, the Republicans think they're going to pull the Democrats into a trap, and Mitch McConnell said he wants a vote on the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal, there's not really anything to vote on because it's basically a visionary document. It doesn't have a lot of specifics.
Well, they did introduce a resolution in the House, right? Like you say, it's right. Not a set of bills that actually enacts policy or has a budget or anything, but it is a resolution for the big, the sense of the big ideas in the Green New Deal. And now Mitch McConnell, as he sees it, is calling their bluff, and he wants to get Democrats in the Senate on the record either rejecting this because it looks too radical to them or embracing it, and then Republicans will run against them.
Well,
on it,
I'm not sure that's going to work for the Republicans. You know, people are so traumatized by what Spike Lee calls Agent Orange, that they actually think that, you know, the Republicans, oh, they're always smarter politically, they always have it figured out. This president, I actually like Elizabeth Warren's description of him too, the large orange elephant in the room. He is at historically unpopular levels. He has never broken 50%. He hasn't even broken 45%. There has been no president since the beginning of polling who has ever been as consistently unpopular as Donald Trump. So I think only now are Democrats starting to realize that, he isn't always that smart politically. And he just can, you know, I think of him like a basketball player who can only go to his right. You know, he has no other moves. And that's not enough. His base isn't big enough. So I think they
in 2016, he was the most, according to polling, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my memory says he was the most unpopular candidate ever to run for president,
right,
even including by a few points Hillary Clinton, but he won.
Yes, and he can win again. I'm not saying he's a sure loser. I'm just saying that Democrats should not be traumatized by his seeming popularity, because when you dig into it, he's not that popular. But Democrats, in fact, he's not popular at all. Democrats do have a history of forming a circular firing squad and applying purity tests, which Franklin Roosevelt never would have passed because he would have been seen as you know, a moderate. He didn't. They wanted him to take over the banks in 1933. This is some of what I write about in The Defining Moment. There were a lot of liberals from New York in particular who were sure that he should take over the banks. Just like in 2009, Barack Obama, he's a sellout because he didn't take over the banks. And both Roosevelt and Obama resisted that, as well as some other things from the left. So it's important that there not be litmus tests, or as Sherrod Brown says, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people on what it means to be a progressive. And it's very important that progressives and all the Democrats define themselves as such allow for some room for people to disagree on, say, what would be in a Green New Deal. The only way that becomes dangerous politically for Democrats is if it has politically unpalatable things in it. And that resolution, I don't think, does. It has some rhetoric that kind of extends it to diversity issues and other sort of traditional Democratic issues that don't really have much to do with climate change. I think that was probably a mistake. But it avoids having a carbon tax in there. If they'd had that, which I think we need, but it, that would have been leading with your chin. Look what's happening in France, you know. So there's some political cunning behind this Green New Deal on the part of AOC and also Senator Ed Markey, who was the main Senate sponsor of the Green New Deal.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Alter here in the Green Space, Jonathan from MSNBC and The Daily Beast, and now an HBO documentarian. And so here you are, a renowned national political analyst who writes about the national condition and writes books about presidents and history. And you made an HBO documentary about two columnists from the New York City tabloids. How come?
Well, first of all, I have two co-directors and co-producers, Steve McCarthy and John Block. And we spent more than 3 years on this. This is a film about speaking truth to power, which we think is, you know, a very important message right now. Donald Trump is only in it once, and it's from 30 years ago. When
we're going to play this clip,
yeah.
So
okay,
no spoilers.
I won't get ahead of myself. But so we have a tremendous number of major American figures, from, you know, Tom Wolfe and Tom Brokaw to Robert De Niro and Gary Trudeau and many others who are in this film, and they all, I think, recognize, as we did, that. That there was a time when giants roamed the earth, and those giants, believe it or not, were print journalists. So Jimmy Breslin was so famous that he hosted Saturday Night Live. Can you imagine a print journalist now hosting Saturday Night Live? And Pete Hamill was so sort of big in the culture that he was dating Jackie Onassis, the most famous woman in the world, and Shirley MacLaine, a top movie star, at the same time. And Jimmy wrote a column about it.
I know about it. Oh, Jimmy wrote a column.
But I mean, I just mentioned that because when they would stand up for ordinary people and ordinary New Yorkers, in often against the tide of popular opinion, they were modeling the behavior that we need from journalists today. And the situation today is that, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and other national news organizations are doing a really good job, I think, covering Trump in Washington. Not so good during the campaign in 2016, but good now. The crisis is at the local level. And as one of the people in our film, Richard Cohen, a columnist, says, it's at the State House and City Hall that your pocket gets picked. And because of structural changes in journalism, local news now is in real trouble. And so one of the things we're trying to do in this film is to explain how vitally important to community building it is to have these voices that are comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, which is what we are supposed to be doing in journalism.
So here's a clip from the film in which an actor playing Jimmy Breslin reads from one of Breslin's columns from the 1980s about a very high-profile incident back then when a white guy on the subway named Bernhard Goetz, being hassled for money and who had previously been mugged, shot four teenagers of color who had approached him. Remind me, who's the actor who plays Breslin?
Michael Rispoli, who played Jackie April Sr. on The Sopranos and is in The Deuce right now. Pete Hamill reads his own words, and both Jimmy Breslin, who died in 2017, and Pete Hamill are in the film a lot. They're not played by an actor on screen, but Jimmy was too old to read his old columns, so we hired Michael.
And we will play one a little later of Pete Hamill reading one of his. But so here is this reading of, sounding a lot like Breslin, by the way, this Jimmy Breslin column on the Bernhard Goetz case from the 80s. And then also in this clip, immediately after that reading, is the real life Breslin having a short, testy exchange with someone about it.
They burned down something irreplaceable in New York this week, and there were people who looked at the ashes and turned them beautiful. A man on a subway took out a gun and shot four people, two in the back, and ran away. One of the two shot in the back was 19, and he will be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. There were people who praised the gunman. As lawlessness was applauded, we in New York arrived at the sourest of all moments, when people become what they hate. Would the gunman have fired, and would people now be jubilant if the four had been white? Almost no one wants to hear that question, because it would shorten the celebration.
Mr. Breslin, if somebody were to attack you, would you just stand there with your arms out and not protect yourself?
I hope I fight back, and I also hope I wouldn't shoot two people in the back and another one in the side because he didn't turn around quick enough that I could shoot him in the back.
So, that from Jonathan Alter's HBO documentary, Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artist. Why do you include that reading and that scene?
Les Payne, the late columnist for Newsday, African-American columnist, said that during the Bernard Goetz case, he thought it was the most frightening time of all of his 50 years in New York journalism, because the entire city was on the side of the so-called subway gunman or death wish gunman. He had seen a Charles Bronson movie where Charles Bronson shoots some muggers on the subway. And so it was, as Les Payne describes in our film, it was basically Jimmy Breslin against the entire city of New York, including many African-Americans even, who were so upset by crime levels. There were more than 2,000 more murders a year than there are now in New York City, that they kind of thought that vigilante justice was okay. So for quite a while, and that clip you heard was Breslin on the old Phil Donahue show, and Phil says to him, you know, you are singing an awfully lonely tune, Mr. Breslin, and he was. Then it comes out that Goetz is a lunatic, and he actually is on tape in custody saying, if I'd had more bullets, I would have shot them over and over and over again. I would have unloaded every bullet I can. He just wanted to kill black kids.
And those clips were in the film too.
And basically, I mean, I think we all know from Ferguson and other more recent cases that this is an issue. But 30 years ago, our guys were standing up in ways that most people were not.
So listeners, who was a Pete Hamill or Jimmy Breslin reader and wants to say anything about them? Or maybe a working journalist inspired by them in your work. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or who has a question for Jonathan Alter about Breslin and Hamill, or journalism then and now, or about original New Deal versus the Green New Deal, or anything in national politics that's in the news right now. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. His documentary, Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists, currently running on HBO and HBO On Demand through March 4th. By the way, you can watch The Brian Lehrer Show when we're in the green space. If you want to see a live video stream of this show and you're merely listening on the radio right now, you can go to WNYC's website or WNYC's Facebook page or the green space website. So we'll also hear a clip of Pete Hamill reading from one of his columns about Donald Trump. But first, here's a Trump clip from back in the day that sets it up. And this is the one you were referring to before. Remember, after the Central Park Five were arrested for raping the woman who became known as the Central Park Jogger, Trump called for them to get the death penalty, despite not having even allegedly committed murder. And back then, in 1989, Donald Trump said this.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it. And it's more than anger, it's hatred. And I want society to hate him.
I want society to hate him. By the way, here in the green space, you can raise your hand if you have a question for Jonathan. We'll come around with a microphone. Jonathan, it was bad enough then when he said that. It's so chilling now with him as president of the United States, still selling hate from the White House as a political technique, and as we heard in that clip, as a positive American value. How does it make you feel knowing that stuff sells?
Well, first of all, just to finish the story of the Central Park Five, as Spike Lee points out, 13 years later, another man confessed to the crime and his DNA matched. So if Trump had his way, five young African-American and Latino men would have been executed for a crime they did not commit. Think about that for a minute. We have a president of the United States who was willing to kill people who had, it turned out, had not committed a crime. That tells you everything that we've learned about his contempt for the rule of law, contempt for our Constitution. It began a long time ago. And I think it's, you know, it's useful to have some historical context about these guys. A lot of us in New York have been following him for years, but, you know, for a long time he was sort of a joke. And I think reminding people that even then he wasn't a joke, he was a menace, helps us understand a little more what we face now. But I want to stress
that. Was that, by the way, Obama's line at the White House Correspondents' Comedy Dinner that got Trump so enraged? People are hearing you might run for president, and they're asking, will you run as a Democrat or a Republican? I know you'll run as a joke.
Yeah, and that, you know, a lot of people who know Trump say that's why he ran for president. Just this guy who in his State of the Union address, you know, last week said, oh, we've got to get past revenge politics. Well, he invented modern revenge politics. He ran for president to get revenge over Obama joking about him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and made up these lies about, you know, his birth certificate, which is what brought him into politics. So I just want to stress that Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artist, is not a Trump film. Like, what you heard is basically what you get from Trump. And it's actually a very funny and ultimately tragic film because of things that happened in Jimmy Breslin's personal life. But we did want to remind people that some things never change. And there's another soundbite from Pete Hamill, one of his columns, where he talks about it. Are you going to do that one?
I think
one?
That's what we have.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting this. Ahead of you.
No, it's just
I didn't know whether you had that or not.
We have mind meld.
Wow, we really do. Thank you.
So here is Pete Hamill reading a column of his about Trump. Now, Jonathan, was this from 30 years ago, or was this a more recent one looking back? Do you know?
This one was from just a few months after the Central Park 5 case.
Okay.
Snarling and heartless and fraudulently tough, insisting on the virtues of stupidity, it was the epitome of blind negation. Hate was just another luxury. And Trump stood naked, revealed as the spokesman for that tiny minority of Americans who lead well-defended lives. Forget poverty and its causes. Forget the degradation and squalor of millions. Fry them into passivity.
So that's Pete Hamill, the real Pete Hamill, who is just a very soulful presence in our film. And Jimmy and Pete were both these Irish-American columnists, but they were very different, as the comedian Colin Quinn points out in the film. They had very different styles and approaches. Pete was also foresighted in when he was, for instance, reporting on the Kent State shootings in 1970, and he wrote a column where he talked about how the slovenly rhetoric of a president, Richard Nixon, who put Pete on the enemies list, you know, can lead to violence. And that's where I think we're going now today. We just saw at this event in El Paso that a Trump supporter attacked a cameraman from the BBC. We're going to see more of that. And, you know, I just pray that none of us in journalism are killed, but we will be assaulted, because that's what happens when you have a demagogue who is trying to use hate and calling us the enemy of the people, you know, which is an old Stalinist line. And when you stigmatize a group of people as an enemy of the people, they're no longer your opponents or your adversaries. What do you do to your enemy? You attack them sometimes physically. So we're going down a pretty dangerous road. But one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of this does resonate from the Nixon administration. And Agnew attacked Pete Hamill personally, the, quote, irrational ravings of Pete Hamill, and a lot of other journalists in ways that we find sort of amusing now, because William Safire wrote, you know, funny lines for him, like calling us nattering nabobs of negativism, is what Agnew said about the press. So that's nicely humorous alliteratively, but at the time it was also kind of scary. So in some ways we have been here before.
Let's take a question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hey, good morning. So I don't know how many of you got to see Howard Schultz last night, but I thought I had a pretty strong idea that I like this Green New Deal. And then some of the metrics that were applied, I said, well, I don't know anymore. Do I like or do I not like? So
I did not see Howard Schultz last night. Did he do a town hall meeting on CNN, something like that?
Yeah.
So, for example, he said, I think one of the metrics, he said you'd have to modify 3,000 buildings a day. I think 3,000 a day. Another metric was the cost of the program would have been, I mean, it's something like it would bust the budget. So it's not that new. We want to do everything very quickly, very well, and we can't afford it.
A number of people are seizing on this idea that it would require retrofitting every building in America, something like that.
So this is in some ways a perilous time for progressives who want a Green New Deal, because it's like a blank slate, and Trump and Howard Schultz, who has no business getting press coverage right now. You shouldn't get press coverage just because you're a billionaire. You know, if he gets to 10% in the polls or something, then maybe the press should be paying attention to him, but they should be ignoring him now. And people should understand that if he does run, he will very possibly reelect Donald Trump, because even if he only gets the 4% where he is right now, most of that would come from Democrats. So he's this would be, you know, one of the most selfish, destructive things imaginable if this man, Howard Schultz, whose coffee I like, but if he goes ahead and runs for president. What he's raising is important for Democrats to think about, because you've got to have a smaller target of opportunity for the other side. And if McConnell and Trump and others can make this Green New Deal into a negative, that would be a real problem. So progressives have to say, no, we're not, we don't have anything in there that says you retrofit 5,000 buildings a day. These are aspirations. And, you know, when John F. Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon by the end of the 1960s, you know, people didn't say, well, if you do that, it's going to cost X, Y, and Z. First of all, 9 years earlier, you can't even guess at what it will actually cost. The cost of retrofitting buildings could come way down. None of these numbers that are applied to it by the left or the right have anything to do with reality. So the whole Green New Deal should just be looked at as a way of focusing the attention of the country on climate change and job growth at the same time.
Let me take a phone call from Julie in Hastings on line 2. Julie, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Alter. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about the question of, are there any visionary, gutsy journalists like Breslin and Hamill today? And one that popped into my head, possibly, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but just as a reader, was David Gonzalez, who spotlights the neighborhoods of New York, but then takes the lesson to a national, even lyrical level.
The Times.
So David and I were colleagues at Newsweek in the 80s. I worked at Newsweek writing a column for more than 20 years. He's a great example of that. This work is still being done. Dan Barry and Jim Dwyer, who are both in Breslin and Hamill Deadline artists, and they are doing this work all the time. And then there are quite a number of other people in other cities who are still doing it, but there are not nearly as many as there used to be. And so, you know, if they say there are a million stories in the Naked City, a lot of those stories are not being told. And we're all poorer for that, that we don't have this vibrant local news. And you have these private equity firms that are buying up local newspapers, closing them, or radically cutting their staff. And then selling off the real estate. So there's sort of vulture capitalism that is really hurting local news. And then in some cases, like at the New York Daily News, it's just the internet and other market forces. They used to have 400 people working there. They now have 45 journalists. So you just can't cover a city the size of New York in any kind of effective way with what's going on.
The financial crisis, the business model crisis for journalism, notwithstanding, though, the review of the film in The Atlantic praised Hamill and Breslin certainly for being journalists who came from the working class, writing about people who were disenfranchised. But the writer, Sophie Gilbert, says the movie glossed over, for as good as it was in other ways, how the ribald culture, she put it, might have helped keep a generation of non-white male talented reporters on the sidelines, and also makes it seem like good grassroots journalism went out with Breslin and Hamill when there really is a new generation of loudmouth, community-focused, diverse journalists changing the world today.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because we've had about 40 reviews, and even Sophie Gilbert's was very positive, saying, you know, you should see this film. But I think she makes an interesting point. It's always easy to ask somebody to make a film different from the one they were making. But at the end of our film, we have Les Payne, who, as I mentioned, died not long after we interviewed him. And he joins Earl Caldwell, another well-known African-American columnist for the Daily News. They don't believe that Jimmy and Pete were preventing this young generation from coming up. So it would have been wrong for us to put that in the film. They believe that Jimmy and Pete did more for African-American journalists than any other journalist they knew. Now, are there more voices now from the community? Do we have a greater diversity of voices? Yes. Is that a good thing? Absolutely. And you know, Robert Krulwich, Les Payne, Gloria Steinem, and others all said at the very end of our film, and maybe Sophie, thought we didn't do enough on this. They all said that there are great people coming along. Spike Lee also, that right. we've passed the baton to a new generation. So I'm very hopeful about that new generation. There's a lot of talent out there. The problem is that the business model for local news is broken, and we haven't figured out how to make the internet work yet.
And just one other thing kind of on that point, because it should be mentioned, I think, since we're speaking in glowing terms about Jimmy Breslin. He got suspended for a racist, sexist rant against a young Korean-American woman journalist who criticized him. It made me think today he might be banished for that rather than suspended for 2 weeks, and maybe he would deserve it. So
yes,
is
maybe.
There a story of white male privilege here with these two as well, or with him?
Well, we certainly wanted to raise that, and you know, we dealt extensively in the film with this moment, which was the lowest moment of his career, where he insulted a Korean-American reporter at Newsday in unforgivable terms, and we leave it, you know, to the viewer to decide whether it was right to suspend him or whether he should have been fired at the time, as Newsday considered doing. I think one of the things that we wanted people to think about is this concept of zero tolerance that is now, I think, becoming a little bit of a problem for the Democratic Party, because you can get yourself in a bind. It sounds good, but whether it's on drug use, where it doesn't really work in schools, or on some of the Me Too questions, where the Harvey Weinsteins get conflated with the Al Frankens, you know, do you want to have like a zero tolerance for everything? And one of the things we tried to raise in the film, without letting Jimmy Breslin off the hook at all for this terrible thing that he did and said, is what would have happened if he had been fired? So he did some really important work after that, really important, particularly on race issues. And, you know, you do have to think, as you're assessing, well, nowadays he would be fired. Are we losing anything?
And maybe he would have been replaced by that young Korean-American woman journalist who might have done
good work. By that time, not only because she was working there, but by that time the newsrooms were fully integrated and had many women and minorities working for them. So those guys weren't standing in the way of by that time. I don't think that it's a sort of a binary question. Mm-hmm. You either get these old, you know, these old progressive Irish Americans, or you get this new generation. You want both. You want a mix.
We just have a minute left. I want to end with one piece of breaking news. I see it's being reported that it looks like Trump will sign the bill to avert another government shutdown and lick his wounds and fight another day another way. But does this whole episode mean anything for you as a political analyst for 2020? We should remember the Republicans lost a shutdown in 2013, but they did really well in the midterms the next year.
Yeah, so it's too early to know how any of this will play out, and we're not going to be talking about this very much in 2020. But what it does indicate is that Trump is a horrible negotiator. I mean, he could have had $25 billion for his wall in 2018, and he's gonna get like, what, $1.4 billion, and it's not even really for a wall. And so
if he had just agreed to DACA without tacking on limits on legal immigration.
Right. His meanness got the better of him on that deal, which he walked away from. And then he could have had a deal that was even better than this in December. And he blew that off because President Ann Coulter told him to. And, you know, so this guy is not the sharpest knife in the drawer all the time. And I think it's just important to recognize that because we get scared. He's so obnoxious. He's such a bully that people tend to cower in front of bullies. And I think Nancy Pelosi in particular is really modeling how to stand up to him.
I think Vice President Limbaugh gave him a pass on the air yesterday.
Right, that's
and
right.
So we have this breaking news this morning. Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists, will next air on HBO Signature this Sunday, February 17th at 1:45 p.m., and it's available on demand through March 4th. Please thank Jonathan Alter.
Thanks.
Live from the Green Space, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More after this.